dead 24th June 2015, interviewing James Lockhead. James, can you tell us about your involvement in the 1985 Mustek movement?
Mustek was a very serious moment. But Mustek's struggle actually was a struggle of women workers in the free trade zone in Penang in 1985. Went through until 86 as well. That time I was working in Kenita in USM.
What is Kenita?
Kenita is this project, Kanak Kanak Dan Wanita. Actually, women and children in development. It's a sort of autonomous project, but it's within the School of Social Science, run by Wazir. In those days, run by Wazir Jahan Karim. So my role in Kenita was a little bit some research, but I was doing a lot of work with different NGOs and some of the basically civil society. You know. And anyway, my interest is, of course, in community-based work and workers' struggles and so on and so forth. So I had been doing some work in Sungai Batu in Telukumba with some of the younger resident, younger population, some of the teenagers. And part of that work, you know, was about the effect of free trade zones on a population like Sungai Batu, which is actually a traditional fishing village, but a lot of the dynamics for work had changed because of the factories. So the younger females were being taken into the factories as workers, and it was something like new. It was a new thing. And this all followed the sort of change in economic policy, so the choice for the economy in Malaysia, but especially in Penang, because they were so successful at it, was to change from the import substitution, actually agriculture sort of base, and then what industrialization policy there was in the 60s, was import substitution. And it didn't work. A lot of unemployment, a lot of dissatisfaction, particularly within the urban areas. And of course, 1969 brought a lot of attention to actually, we need a change of direction on a lot of issues. And one of the issues was employment, particularly for the younger generation, I suppose. So from the 70s, early in the 70s, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, what can we do, what can we do? And so by the mid-70s, places like Penang were implementing export-oriented industrialization policy. So this is where you attract multinationals, so you attract global industry to, in this case, Penang, and you become part of a global production line. But the idea is that you create lots of employment, and you don't need to spend too much money doing that because the multinationals will do that for you. But what you offer the multinationals, of course, is a whole lot of incentives, tax incentives, pioneer status, land, etc. And you're offering them a workforce. So you're offering them a workforce, in this case, a female workforce, which the multinationals liked. And, you know, one could argue that they liked female workforce because they were docile, they were productive, extremely productive. They concentrated extremely well, but they were docile, they had no unions, and they worked for low wages. So the policy was actually extremely successful in the sense that, you know, suddenly Penang was a Silicon Island of the East, the biggest exporter of semiconductor chips. Lots and lots of investment. So mainly in textiles and electronics. And female employment. I mean, employment was sort of something like full employment. And employment including female employment. So
you mean they do not have union is because they were banned from forming a union, or only the female were banned, or actually all workers around are not allowed to have a union?
Yes, some industries were allowed to unionize. Slightly misleading because I was just thinking electronic, but actually some of the factories, for example, the textile industry had state-based unions. So they had a Penang Textile Workers Union. The electrical factories had the Electrical Industry Workers Union. But the electronics, which was the biggest industry in Penang didn't have a union. And there's lots of stories about why they didn't have a union. People would say that the multinationals didn't want it. Some of the multinationals would argue that that's not necessarily true, but the government of Malaysia didn't want it. But whatever it was, the government of Malaysia refused to recognize a union for electronic workers, despite the fact that there was a very long campaign to get a union established, led by the Electrical Industry Workers Union, which is actually the union that should also be allowed to unionize electronic workers, and through the MTC, from Malaysian Trade Union Congress. So this was a big campaign that had been going on for years and years and years, had been taken to the ILO many times, but the government of Malaysia absolutely refused. And they kind of refused by not doing anything. They didn't say no, because that would ILO would jump on them. So they kept saying, well, we're investigating, we're thinking about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they were taken to court a few times, and I mean, it was a big campaign. But the end result was that there was no union in the electronic industry at that time, 1985-86. Which meant that actually what happened in Mostek, for example, was a good example of what happens when you don't have a union. There's no protection for the workers at all. So actually the union, the factory, the multinational companies can treat you badly now.
From Kenita, how do you know Mostek, and how do you get to know the workers?
So, of course, and by 85, this whole phenomenon of free trade zone, of women workers coming from rural areas, coming into an urban setting, had become like actually a huge issue for international researchers. People loved coming to Penang to research, what's happening to women, the patriarchy of the factory, the exploitation of the women workers, global production lines, how it worked. Here was a multinational like, Hewlett Packard, for example, and how they just arranged their global production line in a way that maximized their profit and, of course, people would argue, just use workers, and wherever they could find cheap labor, they'd go. So it was a big thing. So we kept getting people coming in saying, because Kenita was something like women's research center, so people all the time would be coming to use us as a base and then to access whatever research they're doing from Kenita. Anyway, I was interested, like I say, because I was in Sungai Batu, and there was this center run by USM. Actually, it had been taken over by USM. They had a project also in the School of Social Science called the Urban Services Project, which had taken over a project which was a young workers' education project, and that was based in Baru, and in right close to the free trade zone. So there was actually a building, a house, which in the old days had been run by the Family Planning Association of Malaysia, and a friend of mine used to be very much involved in that, Alfred Vengadasalam. So Alfred had been one of the key workers in that project, which was aimed at actually providing some kind of support to people working in the factories. It wasn't explicitly at that time a sort of rights-driven project. It was in some sense a meeting place, a social meeting place. It was a little bit income generating, but to provide alternative possibilities for employment, some skill training. So when it was taken over by the Urban Services Project, the person who was in charge was Lynn. So she became absolutely crucial in this whole Mostek thing, because the Urban Services Project place in Bayan Baru became something like the meeting place for Mostek workers, for example. It became the center where everybody would come.
So you
every
also
day.
Went to the center from time to time.
So I knew them, and I used to do an English class at the center, so I knew them as well. So basically, I knew most of the people just from doing other things, and then it all came together in terms of Mostek.
Just now you mentioned about the female workers, they were cheap laborers. You know how How much wages did they receive monthly?
You ask these questions. 1985. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. But what I can safely say is that a lot of them relied on overtime, as they do now. So the base wage wouldn't have been, I really can't remember. I wouldn't want to guess. You can easily look it up in a paper, right? But it's something like a wage that you need to supplement, especially if you're supporting families. Having said that, of course, one of the sort of dichotomies is that, you know, for a lot of researchers, including myself.
Okay, so we continue about cheap labor and low wages.
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things that we can, so one of the dichotomies, one of the interesting things is that, you know, researchers, including myself, would say, of course, that, you know, this is cheap labor. Actually, it's labor that's exploited in the sense that they produce far more than they're paid. So I think at that time, people used to say that workers used to produce 14 times the worth of which they're paid. So, of course, the multinationals are extremely happy, they're making lots and lots of money. But if you ask the workers themselves, of course, they would actually say they're fine. And this is one of the things, is that, you know, everybody would come and say, oh, you know, terrible, terrible, patriarchy, et cetera, which I totally would say also. But at the same time, one has to bear in mind that, you know, a lot of the workers, given the fact that they're coming from a situation when, of course, the young females are coming from a situation where they're actually not, haven't been earning any money at all. And now they're coming into a situation where they are earning their own money. So in a sense, they're something like independent. They have money to spend on what they want to spend on. So they can go shopping, which, you know, of course, people used to love going shopping in what spare time they had. And they would be able to remit some money back to their families or their parents or whatever it is. And so they had a slightly different take on the whole thing. And that's basically how capitalism works, right? Is that they keep people just about happy enough to, at least they try to, so they don't really rebel. But, you know, when you look at it, I mean, you know, this is, they're producing so much wealth or profit for the companies.
But how did that affect their families at that time? Because, you know, usually women, they will only stay at home and take care of their children. So when this woman, they went out to work, so did it bring any difference to how they take care of their family and all that?
it works on, I mean, different answers to that. Depending what level we're looking at. So again, one of the things about that whole time when so many researchers were coming and writing so much stuff about women workers and this new sort of phenomenon. And so one thing that they would pick out is the way in which many of the young women workers fell between two stools. You know, they were coming from a traditional, many of them from fairly traditional kampung, for example, in which their roles were fairly clearly demarcated, so they were actually meant to stay at home and get married, of course, and so on. Now they're becoming independent workers, and actually many of them key workers for the family, because at that time in Penang, actually employment opportunities for younger men were not so great. So for example, in Sungai Batu, a lot of the young men used to just sit around in a coffee shop, and you know, there were a lot of issues. Whereas the young women would bust into the factories, you know, in whatever shift they were working on, free shifts in those days. And so suddenly the young, in theory, they were the economic breadwinners. But this didn't fit, of course, into a patriarchal system where actually the men should be the one. And this caused a lot of tensions between the sexes. So the young men, for example, felt very, very betrayed almost, but you know, actually it was their sisters or female cousins who were making the money, and they were unemployed and were useless in that sense. And so this was a big fracture within a small community. So meanwhile, the older generation also were not at all sure, many of them, how to handle this phenomenon, especially when they saw the younger women. They were really obvious because the free trade zone, basically 70% of the workforce were women, and most of them young women, and were bussed in. So at shift changeover times, you'd have thousands of young women standing around the bus stop in Bayan La Paz and sort of scattered around Penang waiting to be picked up. You'd have these groups of young women. And so they were something like labeled, you know, loose women out for a good time. So a lot of you know, stereotypes again were just plonked on them because of them, not for any reason other than that this was a new phenomenon and it was obvious and people didn't know how to deal with it. And so I remember someone wrote a book called Mina Karan about how hot women, I suppose, I don't know, which basically describes this fact that they, you know, they weren't given the status. They were something like blamed for something like joining the modern consumerist culture and wearing lipstick and makeup and you know, out for a good time, basically. Whereas in fact, actually one should have said, you know, they should be respected and given the proper protection and rights due to any worker, because they are now actually a critical part of the workforce of Penang or Malaysia. But it never quite worked like that, especially in those days. So when it was quite new, people, you know, society was something like shaken up by it. And it was the young women, who particularly bore the brunt of everything, because they were never quite given any recognition for anything, other than that, you know, we're not quite sure about this. And in many cases, you're going astray. You know, we actually don't want to do anything to do with you. Because they used to come back, of course, you know, by the time, because it was so successful, the multinationals were flocking to Penang stroke Malaysia. You know, the buses would go out into Kedah to pick up the workers.
Kedah,
as in Baling and Sikh. And they just go around there and pick up workers to come and work in Penang. Can you imagine? In Butterworth, of course.
Every day. Wow.
So, you know, it was a huge thing. And many of them would go back, and many would migrate from Perak, for example, and come and live in the houses in Bayan Baru, bed share houses, you know, 15 to a house or whatever it was. And then they'd go back for Raya, for example. But they'd go back, you know, with all the new clothes and the makeup and everything. And of course, you know, depending where they're coming from and depending what, you know, how tolerant or intolerant their elders are, they would be slated for, you know, losing their identity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a really tough time, I think, for young women workers. And the only thing, but again, I would go back to, is that when you actually talk to them and say, how do you feel? Actually, most of them would say, fantastic.
Why?
It's such a good time because we're working, we're friends, and we got more than pocket money, and you know, we got our own income, and something like we're independent now. Despite all these pressures coming in. But yeah, it was a funny time, I have to say. Anyway, so this is not quite MOSTECH, but something
okay,
like
MOSTECH. Okay, so we come back to MOSTECH. So what MOSTECH is about? What kind of factory it is?
Yeah, so Penang becoming a free trade zone, so setting up all these free trade zones, so attracting multinationals, etc. So one of the main industries that responded was the electronic industry. So that was, off the top of my head, I can't remember, something like 60% of the factories in Penang were electronic factories, making semiconductor chips. And MOSTECH was one of the biggest of them, and I think they started in 74, if I remember, and employed about 2,500 people in Penang, which was a lot. That was a big factory. And they produced a chip, a particular chip, and my memory is not fantastic, so if I say it's a 64K chip, I think it is a 64K chip, but anyway, whatever it was, they were something like the world leaders in 64K chips, and were making huge amounts of money. And they had a sister company in Kota Baru, but a very small one, which I always thought was interesting, because it was like,
where is their headquarters?
See, you're going to ask me that. It's almost certainly America, but I don't know. Must be California. But I may be wrong. It's a long time ago, you know. Anyway, so 2,500 people, of which most were women. Probably 2,000 were women. Employed in this pretty awful production line, to be honest. But doing quite well. So MOSTECH was doing very well. So the way the factories worked, of course, the factories have got it all worked out, right? So they have, you know, they have a very patriarchal family type culture. So where the workers are made to feel that they're part of a family, and you know, our sister plant is here, and our sister plant in America, and our sister, you know, we're all brothers and sisters together, and we're all part of the same family, and we're all doing fantastic, and you know, this week, so-and-so has won the most wonderful worker of the week award, and we love her forever. And they'll have, you know, they'll have all the right things. They'll have beauty consultations for the work, you know, free, and they'll have annual dinners at which, you know, major stars will sing, like Sheila Mudgett and people like that. And so they really have it off, and they have the newsletter which goes round and, you know, which talks
newsletter.
About...
Newsletter?
Yeah, they have just really worked out. They really worked out. And so, you know, again, if you talk to the workers about how you feel working in Mostek, actually, okay, you know, and they get overtime because the factory's doing very well, so they've got lots of overtime opportunities. So they, you know, if you talk to them in 1984, they'd probably say they were fine. Please don't bother me with all your worries about exploitation and et cetera. You know, just go away, basically. So that is a setup for the factories, for the companies, you know, but they've kind of worked out how to keep the workers happy and how to bring them and you know, lots of benefits, side benefits. Of course, lots of clubs and sports and stuff like that. So what happened was probably towards the end of 1984, there was a big fallout in the global industry, in the global electronic industry. The main thing was that technology advanced. And a 64 chip suddenly wasn't valuable. And Mostek being, you know, some of these companies, you just wonder what they're thinking about. But anyway, in hindsight, I suppose one can easily say that. They had completely, the whole line was dedicated, there was nothing else they were making except this chip, as far as I remember. Because they were so happy and they were making so much money. But suddenly, when the bottom falls out of the market, they got nothing to fall back on. So, and they can't, they're not fast enough in being able to adapt to a different production line and get a different chip in production and so on. So they're really in trouble. And then there was a lot of double stocking, a lot of things were happening. So a lot of things were sort of came together and made this sort of crisis in the electronic industry. So it started sort of showing, I think, in April 1985. In Mostek. Prior to that, in Penang, a couple of factories had closed down pretty much overnight, and some factories already were, reduce hours?
Slow down.
So they were slowed down. There was some slowdown already happening. And so the atmosphere in Penang, a lot of people were beginning to worry a little bit about what was happening, because they could see certain signs that things were not going very well. And then in April, and I think probably already the workers in Mostek are asking the management, are we okay? And Mostek management is saying, we're fine. You don't have to worry about anything. Don't worry, you know, other companies useless, but we're fine. Then in April, I think it was April, they called for a voluntary resignation. So this is a tactic, as you know now, which is done today as well. You know, when people want to downsides, the first thing they tend to do is to ask for voluntary resignation.
So was voluntary, it effective?
So voluntary resignation, I can't remember how many they wanted to get rid of, but the figure of 500 comes into my mind, but I can't remember. Anyway, whatever it was, the voluntary resignation exercise was done in not a very nice way, because there was a lot of pressure put on workers to voluntarily resign. And people, you know, the management were telling them, you know, you better voluntarily resign, otherwise we'll sack you because your work record is terrible or because whatever it is. And of course, they were also asking some of the older, the longer serving workers to resign because, of course, their wages were, their increments had made them slightly more expensive than the new ones. And so, of course, the longer serving workers who'd been there for 10 years, 11 years, were extremely upset, as you can imagine. And had a certain influence within the workforce because they're the older generation, so they have some kind of status. So when they get upset, of course, everybody's beginning to think, you know, something is seriously wrong. And so after that exercise, I can't remember how many they actually got rid of, but it was possibly around 500. Of course, the workforce now was extremely worried and kept going to the management and saying, "Are you sure we're okay?" And they said, "No, no, it's okay now." We had to do a little, you know, "I'm so sorry we had to do that, but it's okay now, we're fine, we're fine, we're fine." So the workers kept being reassured that everything was all right. But meanwhile, around Penang, a lot of things were not, or clearly not all right. And so the atmosphere was very tense, and the workers were very, very nervous about what was happening. And so you could see already the beginning of a leadership within the factory, because those were the ones that were going to management saying, are you sure you're okay? Are we sure? And they keep saying, "Yes, we're sure, we're sure, no problem." So, shall I just keep talking?
Yes,
continue. In September, was it September? End of September, somewhere around the end of September, 1985. One day the workers came to work, the shifts, right? So there are three shifts. So I think it was a morning shift came to work. And then after they finished, they were told, "Can you clear your lockers?" And so they said, "Huh?" And so, "Can you clear your lockers? Because we are renovating the lockers," or doing something like that. So, and you've got a week off. Take a week off because we're going to do some renovations. So, of course, some workers were extremely happy to have a week off, but some of them were immediately realized that this was something was really seriously wrong. So again, they went to the management and said, "Excuse me, you know, what on earth are you doing? Because this looks serious." And so they said, "No, it's nothing wrong." And then this was Friday, I think, end of the week. And so take a week off. So then I think on Monday or even on Saturday, people started getting letters saying, "You've been laid off."
Everybody?
I think they kept 200. Something like that. They pretty much downsized. In the old days, I had this image that they'd actually closed the gates and put a thing on. But actually, when I recall, it wasn't quite like that. They kept a very minimum staff. So we're talking about 1,700 people being laid off pretty much overnight. Something like that. Or maybe a bit less. No, because of course they'd had a voluntary retrenchment exercise. So maybe 1,200, about somewhere around there. 1,200, 1,300 people laid off. Suddenly, you know. So some of the more militant leader workers, who were the leaders, immediately started a picket. Immediately. But if I remember, that Monday already, there's quite a big picket outside the factory with placards and saying, you know, "Cannot do like this," and "Can you explain what's going on and what's happening, and you can't treat us like this," and so on and so forth. And I think what was quite interesting about the whole Mosdek issue generally, and this particular moment in time in the Mosdek thing, so immediately, was the speed at which the workers came together, women workers came together to protest about what was happening to them, in a way that, you know, actually hadn't really been witnessed before. And it was like, people were totally taken by surprise. The state government, for example, was totally taken by surprise. The management definitely were taken by surprise, and so were the rest of the free trade zone companies. And national government also taken by surprise, because the first day there was a picket, then I think it was the third day, which was presumably the Wednesday, they already were marching to Komta, you know, where the chief minister was sitting in his office.
From the factory to...
I mean, I can't quite remember how they got to there, but they basically went to Komta and took over Komta third floor, sang songs. I mean, it was a big thing. Completely disrupted. I mean, there must have been nearly 1,000. Because the response was fantastic at the beginning. Everybody joined the picket because they were absolutely so angry with the whole situation. And they took over Komta and they petitioned the chief minister. I think the acting chief minister, I don't think the chief minister was here now when I think about it, but the acting chief minister, so someone came down and tried to placate them, and they just, you know, said, "Excuse me, you're our state government, so what are you doing to protect all of, you know, we're in, basically we've lost our jobs, we've lost our income, Many of them had husbands also. I mean, there were some men working in a factory, so there were husband, wife, and both lost their jobs. So it was a really, really big thing. And the anger and the organization shown by the women was amazing, to be honest, because, like I say, you know, normally people would describe women workers in Malaysia as docile and, you know, easily manipulated, blah, blah, blah. But now, when things go wrong, you can really see, but, you know, they're not going to take it lying down. And so this whole thing came up. And for 30 days, nonstop, they picketed. Every day, they picketed outside the factory. Very often, they'd go around the free trade zone, and lots of leafleting. Why we are picketing, what are the issues? And so lots of people in the free trade zone got to know and support them. It became extremely visible. And then now and again, they do stunts like take over Compta. There was poster campaigns. There was different people giving speeches. You know, the deputy prime minister came and they met him. And then the prime minister came to Butterworth and they kind